This is Fresh Air.
Yes, sir, when you see a guy reach for stars in the sky, you can bet that he's doing it for some doll.
When you spot a John waiting out in the rain, chances are he's insane, as only a John can be for a Jane.
When you meet a gent paying all kinds of rent for a flat that could flatten a Taj Mahal,
call it sad, call it funny, but it's better than even money. That guy's only doing it for some doll.
We're listening to the new cast recording of the current Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls. We're going to find out how Guys and Dolls first became a musical from one of the men who created it. My guest, Cy Feuer, was one of the producers of the original 1950 production. Feuer and his partner, Ernest Martin, came up with the idea of a musical based on a Damon Runyon story. And they hired composer Frank Lesser, who gave us one of Broadway's best scores. Together, Feuer and Martin also produced two Cole Porter musicals, Can Can and Silk Stockings, as well as The Boyfriend, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, and Little Me. More recently, they produced Liza Minnelli's review The Act and the film adaptations of A Chorus Line and Cabaret. Feuer's story of Guys and Dolls begins with one of those proverbial phone calls.
My partner called me from California. There was and he had just finished reading a book called Guys and Dolls. There's no story called Guys and Dolls. This was a collection of Runyon stories. And he called me and he said he thought it was that the idea of doing a Runyon musical, what did I think of it? But we were both Runyon fans, and I responded to it. And also, he thought that Guys and Dolls was a terrific title.
How did you decide on Frank Lesser to write the score? A great choice, obviously.
Well, Frank did our first show. Show before the Guys and Dolls. And also, Frank and I go way back together. I was a musical director and knew Frank. As a matter of fact, I put Frank and Julie Stein together on a picture out at Republic. So we were all old friends. And Frank, at that time, was principally a lyricist. He did not write the music. He had done a few things in the Army during the war. But he was really a lyricist working with some very well-known composers. And you know, we used him on our first show.
That was Where's Charlie?
And Where's Charlie, yes. Hal Arlen was supposed to do the music and Frank the lyrics for Where's Charlie. And we were all living in California at the time. And at that time, Harold's house burned down. And his wife was very upset. She was having some problems anyway. And his burned down with all the memorabilia and everything that they owned. And he came to us and said, look, fellas, I can't go to New York. I've got too much. This is too upsetting. The family is just in disarray, and I just can't go. And Frank said, upon hearing this, said to me, listen, why don't you let me do the whole thing? And we decided to do that. And he did.
So that's how Frank Lesser actually started writing music?
Well, he wrote music before that. He wrote Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition in the Army.
Oh, wow. And, I didn't realize that was his.
Yeah, and he wrote a Western song that was kind of popular. A few things before Where's Charlie. He was just getting into it at the time, you know.
So what was the first song Frank Lesser showed you for Guys and Dolls?
Oh, the first thing he did, I think this was the first, because we never knew where to put it. He wrote it without, in general tone of Runyon, was the Fugue for Tin Horns.
I've Got a Horse Right Here. His name is Paul Revere. That
right.
One.
Yeah. Because that had the general tone of Runyon. And oddly enough, we had the whole show assembled. We didn't know where to put it. It didn't fit in anything. It had nothing to do with the plot. It was about horse playing. And ours was about crap shooting. You know what I mean? And we never dealt with horse players.
Yeah.
But this was a generic gambler thing. You know what I mean? Which he wrote. And it was sensational. And it was dangling there. And Ernie came up with the idea. And he said, listen, if we don't know where to put it, let's open with it because it doesn't have to do with anything. We haven't established any characters yet, so let them just open with it. And we did. We put it into the opening, establishing just the gambling attitude of three of our characters, having nothing to do with the main plot.
It's a great song. Why don't I play some of it?
I got the horse right here. The name is Paul Revere. And here's a guy that says if the weather is clear, can do. This guy says the horse can do. If he says the horse can do. I can't get out in time, cause I'm the morning line. The guy has got him figured at 5 to 9.
That's the fugue for tin horns from the original cast recording of Guys and Dolls. My guest was the original producer of Guys and Dolls, Cy Feuer. Let's talk about the cast of the original production. We just heard a little bit from Stubby K. I think this was the first musical Stubby K was ever in.
That's right.
What, he'd been in the Catskills before that?
Yeah, he'd been in the Catskills. He was a tenor and an entertainer. He might have done some nightclub work. And he was a complete, total amateur. It was really kind of darling the way he approached the whole thing. And the show was directed by George Kaufman, who was very eminent director and big theatrical figure, you know. And he kind of dazzled Stubby. And when Stubby would read a line, he'd read his line and he'd walk down the footlights leading edge of the stage and said, "Was that okay, Mr. Kaufman?" And Kaufman called everybody very formally. He said, "Yes, Mr. K, that's just fine. Just continue. You don't have to check with me after every line. Just read."
You know, it's funny. Stubby K was unknown when he was casting Guys and Dolls. It became, I think it was a rule for a while that you couldn't put on a musical comedy unless Stubby K was in it.
That's right. He became very prominent. He also had a movie career that was very good.
Now, I think you cut one of the numbers right before opening night.
Yeah, you get a lot of this information. Yeah, as a matter of fact, it was a number called Traveling Light. It was a number in 5/4, actually, written by Frank, which is an unusual meter to write a song in. And it was done by Sam Levine and Bob Alder. And Sam was terrible. He just couldn't sing at all. He was kind of tone deaf. And we had them doing this number, and we struggled through it all throughout the out of town, and it was just awful. And finally, I said to everybody, "Listen, I've had enough of this. We're going to get rid of it." And Sam was a difficult man, you know, very tough. So it was before the first preview in New York at the 46th Street Theater. And I called the company on the stage, and I said, "I want you all to take note of this because there's a cut, and you all have to pay attention because it'll affect all of the cues and your entrances and everything. Be prepared because it's a 3-minute cut in this particular scene." And I want the stage managers to note this. Let your wardrobe people know about it in case it affects the change and so forth. And I made this long speech, never getting to what the cut was, you know. And finally, I had the door. There was a door on the side of the auditorium. It led right out onto 46th Street, you see, where I had a cab waiting, you see. And I said, "We're cutting Traveling Light." I saw Sam go white, and I went out the door and jumped into the cab and left.
You were afraid they were going to be so angry that you'd better get the heck out of there?
Just Sam, yeah. And there was nobody that he could yell at because there was nobody around to reverse the decision, you know.
So did they follow your orders after you fled?
Yeah. Well, I told the stage manager and everything beforehand. This was what it was going to be, and we cut it.
Was it a good song?
Wonderful. I had Traveling Light. Yes, I'm traveling light. Got my ticket in my pocket, and I'm ready to blow town. It's in a 5/4 tempo. Very odd.
Uh-huh. Gee, I wonder if anybody's recorded it.
No, it's never been recorded.
Huh. I'd like to hear that sometime. What are your memories of opening night of Guys and Dolls?
Terrific. When the trumpet played First Call, you know, we'd done that whole opening and everything, and then the three guys went to the newsstand and picked up the scratch sheets, and the trumpet played. It was a big laugh. And I turned to my wife and I said, "We're home. This is it. They're ready."
My guest is Cy Feuer, a producer of the original Broadway production of Guys and Dolls. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Broadway producer Cy Feuer is my guest. Now, Guys and Dolls, the revival, is the hottest ticket on Broadway. Did you ever want to do a revival of the show?
We did one. We did when Ernie and I were running the Civic Light Opera at the Los Angeles, at the Los Angeles Music Center. We did it with Milton Berle.
Oh.
And I don't know. You know, it's such a chestnut now. You know, every high school kid in the country has his particular part. And
should I tell you about my summer camp production?
There you go. You know, there was a symposium of high school kids. And I went down and addressed it one day. When they told them that I had produced Guys and Dolls, the whole bunch jumped up. Every kid in the audience, and each one of them had a part.
That's right.
And they came from all different high schools, you know, and some of them came out from New Jersey and so forth, not even local. So therefore, I was very surprised that the idea, you know, it's like you're telling old jokes at the impact of it.
Yeah. So have you seen the new revival?
Yes, I have.
What do you think of it?
Oh, I like it very much.
Uh-huh.
It's very slick and up to date. I thought that what they've done with it is generally very good for contemporary audiences.
What are the big changes they've made?
They haven't any change. They stuck very, very closely to the text, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They made no changes at all. As a matter of fact, even the out-of-date references to Saxon Kleins and Hollanderizing and stuff like that, which is no longer applicable today, they've kept that all in. As a matter of fact, I discussed it with them, with Jerry and...
Jerry's Axis director.
Yeah, and Tony Walton, the designer. And they wanted to know certain things about the construction of the show, which was originally done in what we call one in depth.
Yeah.
You know, it was before you had the state-of-the-art winching that we now use to change scenery. You used to be able to have to bring in a traveler or a curtain in order to change the set. Otherwise, you see the stagehands running around. And the show was designed for that originally, and they decided to keep it that way.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the movie with Marlon Brando and Frank Sinatra?
I saw it recently again. I liked it better this time than I did originally.
It's funny. I have the same reaction. I mean, I like it more as time goes on.
I thought that Sinatra was absolutely wrong for, Sam Levine, Brother Nathan Detroit, is really Jewish. We wrote it with Sam Levine in mind. And he's supposed to be Jewish and have that real Jewish feeling and... Sinatra tried to play it that way, but he's not, you know, flesh and blood. And actually, I thought he would have been a better Sky Masterson, but having seen it recently, I thought that Brando was pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought that Gene Simmons was the best Sarah Brown I've ever seen. She was marvelous. She had exactly the right quality, the right flesh and blood.
Two of the shows that you did, Can Can and Silk Stockings, were had scores by Cole Porter.
Yeah.
Let me ask you what it was like to work with him.
Great. He was just great. Cole was departmental. Cole, you know, when we first went with him, we would defer to him, you know, after it was the great Cole Porter.
Yeah.
And we said, well, here's our idea. We want to do a show about the Toulouse-Lautrec era in Paris up at Montmartre. He thought it was wonderful. We said, okay, now here's a story. He said, wait a minute, boys, don't tell me the story. Tell me the story. Tell me what you want me to write. In other words... you can tell me the terms of the story and what it has to be, but don't ask me to participate in it because I'm no good at that. So you guys go on, do your job, and when it's all done, I'll read it, and then you tell me what the attitudes are, and I'll write it. And he was like in a classroom being given an assignment, you know, and that's the way he liked to work.
Were you happy with all the songs he wrote, or did you have to tell him that you didn't like one of them?
Yeah, sure. In Can Can... he wrote a song, a comedy song in Can Can, and it was absolutely wrong. And I worked with him principally because my job with Fewer and Martin was to do or work on the creative end of it, and Ernie worked more or less on the business end, also had some distance on it and could comment on things with a little more objectivity than I could being involved. Anyway, and I went up to see Cole, and I told him that I didn't think the song was quite right. He took it off the piano, and he tore it up. So I said, wait a minute. I said, you know, I just said that I don't like it, but maybe you ought to look at. No, no, he said, if you don't like it. Now, he said, I can't. He said, I'll do another song, but I can't do it on the same subject. So give me another subject. Give me other jokes.
Did you have to give yourself some kind of pep talk before saying to Cole Porter that the song wasn't going to work?
No, because of his personality. It was very easy. We had worked up a very good working relationship with him, and he was oddly enough, excited about working with us because that was the next show after Guys and Dolls.
Oh, yeah.
And so it was very easy, and he made it easy for you, you know. And I was a musician, so that made it easier as well.
How do you think Broadway has changed since the 1950s when you started, or late 1940s when you started?
Well, principally, we were really in the 40s. principally in the financing. It's just amazing the difference in costs are. As a matter of fact, that's one of the reasons that we're not too enthusiastic about producing any longer, because by the time you raise the money, you don't have anything left for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we used to do, for instance, Guys and Dolls, on its best, one of its best days, took in more at the box office in one day than the original show cost.
You're kidding.
No. I think they took, the original show cost probably around $175,000 or $200,000 or something like that. And they took in more than that at the box office in one day's sale.
Now, how does that compare with the ratio now?
Well, the show probably cost over $5 million.
And you're not going to get that in one day at the box office, that's for sure. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
No, I enjoyed it.
Cy Feuer produced the original production of Guys and Dolls.